If the new year could begin like an opera or a ballet, it would begin with an overture, something warm and uplifting, Gershwin, perhaps, or Rodgers and Hammerstein, or maybe a nice bit of Strauss. As a classical musician and commentator, Miles Hoffman spends a lot of time thinking about good beginnings. A few days ago, he brought in some of his favorite overtures and some notes about how these musical beginnings began.
The fellow who invented the first standard form of the overture was Jean-Baptiste Lully, which sounds very French, except he was Italian, except he worked in the court of Louis XIV. But he developed a form called the French overture, strangely enough, working in France, and it was a slow introduction followed by a fast section. It became the standard form, starting in the 1600s through a good bit of the 1700s.
It's the idea to give you a little taste of the whole deal before you get into it?
Well, you know, Bob, it wasn't originally to give you a taste. That's a good question. The overture has always had a very important psychological function. You're in your street clothes, or even if you're in your fancy clothes, you're living your everyday life. You go to the theater, or you go into the palace, wherever it is. You're having a normal conversation. You take your coat off. You sit down. You need a transition, something that brings you from this world into the world of the imagination. That's what the overture is, and that's always been very important. But at the very beginning, it was just a kind of a generic transportation, you know, from the world of no music, no sound, into the world of sound and art. Later in the 1700s, a composer named Christoph Willibald Gluck developed the theory that it was important to have an overture that prepared us for the mood and the content of the piece. He wrote in 1769, "I have felt that the overture ought to apprise the spectators of the nature of the action that is to be represented." This was pretty revolutionary at the time, that the overture was not just music, but it was something that really would set the mood. If we listen to the overture to Gluck's opera Iphigenia in Aulos, right at the beginning, we notice there's a very poignant dissonance here that tells us something is on its way. Now, the person who then brought this to even greater artistic heights, Bob, was Mozart. And the perfect example of the almost the ultimate mood-setting overture is the overture to Mozart's opera Don Giovanni. It gets very spooky, and those opening chords are the chords that later in the opera we're going to hear associated with the stone guest, the statue of the Commendatore, the fellow that Don Giovanni has killed, the person who will in fact drag Don Giovanni down to the underworld, to the fiery flames.
Did composers write the overture first, or did they tack it on at the end?
I think mostly they wrote it last, Bob, and in fact the story of Don Giovanni is a funny story, because it was the night before, the story goes anyway, that it was the night before the first rehearsal of Don Giovanni, Mozart had not written the overture. And his wife was trying to keep him up, telling him funny stories and giving him stuff to drink. So, come on, Wolfgang, finish the darn thing, you know, write this piece. And he was writing. And finally, whatever she was giving him to drink put him to sleep. And so by 3 a.m., he had fallen asleep. The copyist was going to be coming at 7 a.m. to pick up the parts. And apparently Mozart woke up at about 5, and from 5 to 7, finished the overture.
Well, some do their best work.
Well,
5
so
to 7
fast.
Is a good time five, for me.
For you, that's right. You can relate to that, Bob. He did great work from 5 to 7. He wrote one of the greatest overtures anybody's ever heard.
Aren't there composers who have done nothing but overtures? I think of Rossini.
Well, right, and that's a good point. People have always taken the overtures and played them independently as concert pieces. But in some cases, the overtures last far longer than the works that they're attached to. Rossini is the best example. How many operas do we really know by Rossini? Not too many. The Barber of Seville gets played, and it's also got a great overture. William Tell. I mean, how many people can...
You mean there's something that follows that?
Yeah, that's right, after the Lone Ranger goes away, you know. And as a matter of fact, even the William Tell Overture, we all know the famous bits, but the opening of the William Tell Overture is really quite beautiful.
That's the beginning of the William Tell Overture.
That's right. That is the overture to the opera, and it's not performed very often, I can tell you. And usually when it is performed, I think people say, well, you know, let's just listen to the overture.
Verdi, Wagner, they did some operas. They must have done some overtures.
Yeah, they didn't always call them overtures, though, Bob. Wagner most often used the term prelude, or in German, Vorspiel, and sometimes they're very extensive pieces. One of the more beautiful Verdi overtures is the overture to La Forza del Destino, the Force of Destiny. Many of us know this tune, or first heard this tune, not in Verdi's opera, but in the music for the French movies Jean de Florette and Manon des Sources. You may
great
remember
movies, too.
Yeah, great movies, beautiful tune.
Sounds much more contemporary. Sounds like, you know, Europop to me somehow.
Well, you know, Europop copied the great composers,
so,
Bob.
Yeah.
And when we listen to many of these great works, that's what's so great about them. They sound as if they were written yesterday. They still speak to us.
Miles Hoffman is violist with the American Chamber Players and author of the NPR Classical Music Companion, Terms and Concepts from A to Z.